Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insights and expert analysis from the leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Coming up on the program, the liquor industry increasingly anxious about a massive sin tax increase in tomorrow's budget. New thinking on how to fix or VAT collection as the issue remains front and center pre-budget. Before expropriating land, the government should look at its own inventory, says a leading agricultural economist, and a luxury brand still worth investing in. It's Tuesday, the 11th of March. With just hours to go before the revised budget Wednesday, I guess all eyes on Treasury's next move. After the controversial VAT hike proposal was shelved, sin taxes, particularly on alcohol, are under the spotlight as a potential quick revenue fix. But could higher taxes on alcohol do more harm than good, I wonder? The legal liquor industry is already facing declining tax revenue contributions, while the illicit alcohol market is booming. So will squeezing the sector even further drive more consumers underground? Will it hurt the economy and even shrink the tax base instead of growing it? Joining us to discuss this high-stakes issue is Lucky Ntimani, who's convener of the National Liquor Traders, who's long been an advocate for a more balanced approach to alcohol taxation and regulation. So, Lucky, welcome. And first of all, Treasury, as we well know, is under huge pressure to raise revenue. Why do you believe higher alcohol excise taxes, which are coming down the line anyway, are the wrong solution?
We don't think increasing the excess duty well beyond the inflation is the solution, because this is something that actually we face on a yearly basis and we've made peace with it. We know that every year we're going to be hit with an excess duty, which then gives the government an opportunity to actually create a sustainable but also a predictable environment in a tax base for the alcohol industry, where we can know, for example, that in the next 3 to 5 years, we are going to be hit with this number of tax increase with regards to excise. But we don't get to be in that space in South Africa. It's a problem, because then it means every year it's a guessing game for us as to what could be the number that we'll get from government with regards to the tax increase. So we feel that in this instance, there are two issues on the table. The one is the looming tax hike on Wednesday. But also, we know that government has requested that we make provision and submissions with regards to another increase, this time under the pretense that, you know, increasing excise duty will somehow magically fight alcohol abuse in the country, something that we vehemently deny. Mm. So we are now facing two animals that are all seeking to devour us as the alcohol industry. And we take exception to that. Hence, we've made our submission with regards to government's approach to increasing tests to fight alcohol abuse, but also the issue that we are now faced with on Wednesday, where we might be hit with an increase that is above inflation. We don't think this is a sustainable solution. It's akin to milking a dairy cow.
Do you feel as an industry that you are an easy target and that government sees this and is able to bully you?
Certainly. I mean, at some point, we even made remarks to the effect that we might even be blamed for load shedding, because we are blamed for all sorts of things. There isn't even any proposal, if you look at if the reports that are going around are anything to go by. The government is not even looking at the way it's wasteful expenditure, that it has corruption and incompetence. So it almost seems that the alcohol industry is going to be used to actually compensate for the incompetence of government to be able to manage their budget. So the alcohol industry is always going to be squeezed. But there aren't a lot of numbers to get from squeezing the alcohol industry with taxation. I mean, a 1% increase in excise will only give you a maximum of about 100 million rand, and that is not enough to plug the gaps that we've seen that government has in their budget. But at the same time, the illicit and the counterfeit should be celebrating that, you know, there is this possibility that the excise will increase beyond inflation, because those guys don't even pay a cent, if anything, we can even argue that some of the benefits and the profits that they make from this illicit fund other criminal activities in South Africa. Government has not taken a single step to addressing the issue of illicit or fake alcohol in alcohol.
I want to return to illicit alcohol in just a moment, but you'll be aware there is another argument that taxing alcohol more aggressively is in fact a public health measure and not just a revenue tool, as we have been discussing. How do you respond to that?
I think when they tax alcohol, I mean, we believe that it's meant to discourage people from buying more because now alcohol is going to be more expensive. Those are the things that we've heard from governments, like quotas. But we do believe that, you know, their approach is that they want to make more money because government has run out of options to actually generate revenue. We know, I mean, cities, big metros are unable to collect revenue from the residents. So the alcohol industry represents almost a single entity where government, with certainty, 100% certainty, they know that they're going to collect something. And that means then we're in the process of government. When they want to collect anything, they would always come after alcohol.
So you don't agree it's a public health issue?
No. From what we've gathered and the approach from government is that it's really a two-pronged approach. It's a public health issue, but also it's a way of generating extra revenue. But our issue then there is directing itself, because according to the constitution, this is not their space. This is the space of social development. It's the space of the Department of Health. But somehow Treasury wants to be involved in dealing with health issues in contradiction to its constitutional mandate. But we do believe, based on what we've seen and some public pronouncements from government quarters, that this is seen as a public health issue, but we also believe that it's also a revenue collection issue.
Could you give me a sense of the kind of stress that the industry is currently facing? In other words, what impact, if you're able to quantify it for me, have past excise tax hikes had on legal alcohol sales? Is there data to prove that consumers are now shifting to illicit alternatives, as you've suggested?
So when we look at the study that was commissioned in 2020, at the height of COVID, it was estimated that almost 15 to 20 billion rand has now gone to illicit. And that came at the back of alcohol bans, meaning that people then could access alcohol that was not in the legal space. And that was when we saw a huge boom in the illicit and counterfeit alcohol. So certainly, that alcohol, in the absence of illicit and counterfeit, would have gone to the legal channel. So that is an outright loss to the industry, but also to the fiscus in terms of the taxation that they could generate from such sales. And we know that this number keeps growing. And this is a loss for government in terms of ability to collect excise on even the direct taxation or even company tax from that angle. So we know that at the base level, as you increase the illicit and counterfeit alcohol, you are now obviously damaging the legal economy of the alcohol industry. But we've also now established that if the illicit and counterfeit alcohol was a company in South Africa in the alcohol space, it will actually be number two to SAB. So we've now built a monster that's actually competing head-to-toe with the legal industry.
So just a final question then. Your industry supports, and I think I've got the numbers correct, around 500,000 jobs in South Africa and contributes significantly to GDP, around 9.5%. What would another large excise hike mean for employment should it exceed the rate of inflation come Wednesday?
We believe that there will be losses in jobs created and sustained by the alcohol industry, because as you increase these excess duties, the imports contributions and duties of the raw materials that these companies employ to manufacture these products will also mean that they're increasing. We have seen what the global commodity prices have done to the input costs of these raw materials. So certainly, you cannot have, you know, a rising input costs and also a declining sales as a combination that can sustain a sector. So we see this as a way of decimating jobs in the alcohol space. But also, if you look at the taverns, where a taverner is able to employ between 3 and 5 people, depending on a day of a week, that will also be compromised, because now you're going to have declining sales at a tavern level. And as it stands, with the 43,000 taverns that we have, almost 250,000 jobs are supporting in that space. And these are the township economy contributors. So anything that you touch to affect the availability and affordability of prices in that market is certainly going to affect the jobs that are supported in that space.
As I said at the start of this conversation, it certainly is a high-stakes issue. Lucky Ntamani, thank you very much indeed. The National Liquor Traders Association, you're the national convener. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Ahead of tomorrow's budget and with intensifying debate about a potential hike in value-added tax, some experts are arguing that instead of simply raising rates, we need to modernize how VAT is collected to close the billions lost to non-compliance. And let's explore this in a little more detail now. I'm in conversation with Shannon Friedman, Chief Executive Officer, VAT Modernization South Africa. And Shannon believes that South Africa should be looking at smarter systems like real-time reporting and digital invoicing, all in a bid to improve collection without adding more pressure on taxpayers. And believe you me, there is a lot of that pressure right now. So Shannon, first of all then, welcome. And the system reportedly loses a lot of money annually. Maybe break down where the revenue leakage is happening, who's not paying and why they're not doing that.
Sure, Jeremy. So just to dive straight into it, when it comes to VAT especially, there's tens of billions in leakages each year. Now, that's due to the fact that there's a significant gap between what actually does get collected and what theoretically should get collected based on the amount of economic activity that takes place in this country. Now, a big reason for this happening is just due to the fact that how VAT is reported. Currently, how VAT is reported, and it's been reported this way, I think, since VAT was introduced, is through a monthly or once every 2 months VAT returns, where businesses submit on a very highly aggregated level their total VAT inputs and outputs. And for a very long time, this was the optimal way for businesses to go about reporting their VAT, given the technology we had in place at the time. However, with the introduction of new technologies such as e-invoicing and downstream technology like a real-time VAT reporting, what you're seeing with countries all over the world is they're able to get a lot greater visibility into businesses' underlying transactions by enforcing that they submit their underlying transactions and also verify those transactions through those systems as well. Well, that essentially allows government to get a lot more visibility into what's actually going on with each business's transactions and makes it a lot more difficult for businesses to do typical things of like VAT evasion, such as inflating inputs or understating outputs. It's obviously not the majority of businesses who are doing that, but there is a significant percentage that are doing that with a large amount of money that is causing VAT leakages of around 50 to 75 billion rand every year.
So let me ask you this question then. Is it a case of people willfully not paying, in other words, trying to game the system, or just the implementation or the execution of poor systems within a company itself?
So it's a combination of both. There is definitely an element of, you know, just inaccuracies taking place, errors in reporting, not exactly reporting what you should be reporting. I would say that's probably a small percentage of the VAT leakage issue. There is a large proportion of the VAT leakage that is coming due to the fact that businesses are either creating VAT inputs that don't exist or overstating those VAT inputs as well. So that's largely where a lot of the leakage happens, is just creating this reason for VAT refunds to take place that shouldn't be taking place in the first place.
So in your opinion then, what's the real barrier to modernization? Is it outdated legislation? Is it resistance from business, as you've alluded to, or maybe just a lack of will from SARS?
So it's definitely not a lack of will from SARS. I think SARS is actually quite on board with regards to modernizing its VAT reporting systems. In fact, in 2023, I guess it's already 2 years ago, they've already announced their plans to actually start implementing some of these modernization plans. So it's really just the process of how this all rolls out for businesses. So it's not something that is necessarily not wanting a case of that not wanting to be implemented, but obviously these things do take time, and we obviously have been a bit later than some other countries to actually start this journey of modernizing our tax systems. So it is something that most likely businesses are going to have to modernize their systems. But yes, there is all the whole process of SARS, you know, having the funding to set up the systems in place that they can receive such granular data, and for businesses on their side as well, that they have solutions in place that enable the transmission of data at the level of granularity and at the frequency that SARS would want them to receive that.
So, Shannon, you're making a big play for real-time reporting, but do you think it actually closes the gap, or do you think fraudsters, because VAT fraud does remain a major issue, will just find new ways to move around or dodge the system?
Sure. Look, you're never going to get 100% compliance, whatever you do. But what we are seeing with real-time VAT reporting, and we're seeing case studies play out in countries overseas, such as in Europe and South America, that by creating this greater visibility for governments to see what's going on with transactions, it just essentially becomes too difficult for a lot of players to do what they were doing in order to try and evade their VAT payments. You're seeing in countries such as Italy, where they've implemented real-time reporting systems, they're collecting an extra 6 billion euros in VAT each year. And countries like Brazil and Mexico, who've also claimed that through real-time VAT reporting, they've able to reduce their VAT non-compliance rate by essentially half. So, yeah, you're never going to get a case where it's all catch-all, but it can make a significant impact in boosting our government's VAT collections.
Let me throw another potential obstacle at you. We talk about digital VAT reporting and e-invoicing, great in theory, but we also know that we have a complex informal sector. How do you ensure then that compliance is there without strangling small business in red tape?
No, you're 100% right, and that's definitely what we would not want to do. When it comes to implementing things like real-time VAT reporting, it obviously would be probably something that is at a phased approach where you are targeting your larger businesses or your medium-sized businesses that have proper accounting systems in place and where real-time reporting is the implementation's a lot simpler. When it comes to the informal sector, there obviously is going to be need, thoughts and innovation with regards to how can we include these types of businesses as well. But a lot of the times it could be just that, they're using some sort of technology, but it's something that's more suited towards their needs, where it's simpler. They can essentially operate it like an app or just something that they log into on their side where they're reporting things. It might be a little bit more manual, but obviously at the same time, would want to try and create a solution that as easy for those types of businesses to comply as possible.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Shannon Friedman, Chief Executive Officer of VAT Modernization South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The debate around land expropriation without compensation continues and is intensifying, but one expert is arguing that government should start this entire process by releasing the vast amount of land it already owns. So I guess the question is, does this offer a more practical solution to land reform? I'm in conversation now with Wandile Sihlobo, Senior Fellow at Stellenbosch University's Department of Agricultural Economics. Wandile, a very warm welcome. Maybe this is the best starting point. Do we know how much land government actually owns and why it hasn't been redistributed?
Jeremy, in our estimation at the university, we believe that the government owns through its program called Proactive Land Acquisition Strategy about 2.5 million hectares of farmland. This is not the land that was in former homelands or elsewhere, but rather land that was commercially farmed in the periods between 2006 all the way to 2024 that the government has acquired in the open market basis, but has not distributed it to black farmers with title deeds. And we think it holds a great potential for growth and inclusiveness.
What do you think the key obstacles are then preventing government-owned land from being utilized and redistributed?
I think there has to be a change on a policy approach and just a mindset shift. For a long time, much of this land has been leased to farmers on a short-term leases, and others do get the long-term leases of about 30 years. But ultimately, without tradable long-term leases or title deeds, they are unable to attract capital. But we've also failed on our beneficiary selection process, on ensuring that we select the right people that can actually farm productively that land and collaborate in the process with organized agriculture in an effective way. And I think that going forward, the approach that government should take, perhaps maybe in two phases. One, we must admit that and accept that our approach would rather be what I would call better few, but better black farmers. Not making sure that we benefit large communities, but selecting individuals that can farm commercially and thereafter anchor the others around them. The commercial imperative is important because land reform in general must address two things, in my view: restorative justice, but also economic growth and job creation. The second aspect then is ensuring that the government transfers this land with title deeds to these beneficiaries that will be selected. And I think both the framework of our thinking as well as the policy approach in government should be on that. And I must close by saying on this point, Jeremy, the leadership at the Department of Agriculture as well as on a land reform and rural development in the presidency agrees with some of these views that we need to be marching towards that direction right now.
So why do you think it's so difficult to change the policy then?
I think right now we should not be fiddling on coming up with the new policies, but rather crystallizing about how do we go about the release of that land. And that's exactly what the leadership at the Department of Land Reform and Rural Development and the Agriculture are currently now working on. And I think we have to be faster and gain more momentum on that, because you will recall in 2021, the president in his State of the Nation address talked about what he called the Land Reform Agency. And I think the process of setting that up has taken longer. But right now, there is a lot of pressure where I think that the guys have to put more momentum towards this, because I think it will address in part some of the inequities that we usually talk about when we are looking at agriculture. But most importantly, that land could add value in terms of the growth of the sector and job creation. And I think that's the most critical part, given that in rural South Africa, we read every day about the challenges of joblessness and poverty, and we can't have fertile land lying around and not contributing to resolving those problems.
I suspect this then might be the critical question. In your opinion, would releasing state-owned land make expropriation without compensation unnecessary?
I think in the public discussion, there's a conflation of two things. The land reform process in South Africa and its policy has not changed. It has remained a market-based principle, which goes under those three layers, which is land redistribution and the proactive land acquisition strategy. The 2.5 million hectares of land is under that pillar. Land restitution, which deals with the people that were dispossessed in certain pieces of land, as well as land tenure that affirms people's rights in the land. The Expropriation Act, it's a different mechanism, which is why it doesn't even sit at the Department of Land Reform, but rather on public works. That remains important. Every country does have it when they have to deal with issues of public interest. But what is not necessary is a change on land reform policy. And we haven't changed it as a country, and we remain on that market-based principle that we are in. And these are separate matters, the Expropriation Act, as well as where the land reform process in South Africa sits. But I will say this, and it's important, that if we do as a country march forward with releasing that land with title deeds, pair it with finance, collaboration in farmers' skills training with organized agriculture, I think the pressures about the fact that the sector is still fairly untransformed. Black farmers make up roughly 10% of the commercial agricultural output on average. We could see those numbers change, but most importantly, we could see the sector growing. We suspect it could add plus 30% in its gross value added, as a lot of jobs could also come along in agriculture and its value chain.
So, is there a role here for public-private partnership in accelerating land reform in this process, do you think?
The PPP approach that you are mentioning, Jeremy, is everything. This should not be a matter that is only run by the government, but rather the private sector, organized agriculture, commodity associations. I think they are important, both in assisting on carefully selecting the beneficiaries of land reform, as well as imparting skills and linking these farmers with the market that they would need ultimately, as well as the financiers. And I think the financiers, once the structuring of the land ownership changes, they may perhaps maybe find that the whole concept is more appealing. And I may say that in the discussions that I have been part of, which are in government, the discussion is moving towards that, because there is a recognition that only through PPPs we could achieve this as a country.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Wandile Sihlobo, Senior Fellow at Stellenbosch University's Department of Agricultural Economics.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move now to golden eggs. And for years, the luxury goods industry did seem unstoppable until now. Now, after a post-pandemic boom, the sector has taken something of a hit, share prices falling, and some investors are questioning whether the golden era of high-end fashion, jewelry and watches is maybe over. So is there a major sell-off, or is this just a short-term dip, or maybe a sign of deeper trouble? And could this be a good time to invest? I want to dig into the world of luxury investing in conversation with Jethan Pillay, portfolio manager at Allen Gray. I want to explore the psychology of luxury, the forces shaking up the market, and whether brands like Richemont are diamonds in the rough or maybe just a risky bet. Jethan, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe let's go back, if we can, to start this conversation. What were the key drivers behind the sector's massive growth over the past two decades?
Hi, Jeremy. Luxury industry has actually been quite interesting. You know, we can go back many, many millennia, actually. And even from those days, you know, people have been using items or things to signal things to others. That hasn't changed in modern times. And I think what's been driving the growth, particularly over the last 20 years, you've got a few factors there. You know, the one is kind of a greater reliance on self-purchases. So these are, you know, people who are now entering the workplace, have a bit more discretionary income, and are using that income to buy not just their necessities, but also luxuries. There's also been a greater trend, if we think about what social media has done, there's been a growing trend of not just buying items for kind of self-consumption, but also buying items as a symbol or as a visualization to others. And social media has kind of amplified that by kind of driving growth in a lot of luxury brands. And then naturally, there's the kind of age-old underpins, big romantic occasions where, you know, traditionally luxury goods, you know, that was their bread and butter. But then you've had kind of more occasions that have come up in more modern times.
Now, there has been a sell-off recently. Has the decline been very sharp, or simply something which is part of the normal cycle of business?
Yeah, you know, you can go back again many decades, and luxury, as you would expect, you know, it doesn't grow in a straight line. These things are naturally correlated to global stock markets, to global economies. So, you know, naturally, when global macros are doing well, you know, people feel a bit more confident and they tend to purchase luxury items. And naturally, the converse is true. So the luxury industry has always been cyclical. You know, it's always gone through these periods of big growth. And we saw that in 2020, where as a result of pretty much unprecedented monetary and fiscal stimulus, coupled with the fact that people were locked down in their homes and couldn't spend on experiences, well, you know, all of those excess savings went into luxury goods. Naturally, you know, that kind of had to work its way through the system, and naturally that rate of growth was not sustainable. So what you saw kind of last year, from probably March onwards, was you actually saw a broader sell-off in the industry. Again, not unexpected. Interestingly, you know, since the start of this year, that's somewhat reversed again, because you know, the luxury sector year to date is up about 15%. A share like Richemont is up over 30% in rands from the start of the year. So again, as people gain a bit more confidence that maybe, you know, the global economy is not going into recession, you know, that confidence translates into spending. I think the thing that we're monitoring is the sustainability of that spend.
So what would your concern be around sustainability then? I would imagine driven maybe by the constant fear of recession and also the heightened global or geopolitical uncertainty.
That's right. And if we think about, you know, why we're trying to think about quite carefully, you know, the current level of revenue and earnings that a lot of these companies are making at present, you know, there was a big surge during COVID. And you know, just for some context, Richemont, you know, almost doubled its jewelry sales in 2 years, going from 2021 to 2023. That's explosive type of growth. We understand the factors that were behind it. I think what we're trying to think about quite carefully now as well, you know, can that endure? You know, is it actually you've set a new base and, you know, revenue can grow fairly steadily from this point? Or actually, you know, do we need a reset down and then the growth continues? So there's probably two elements to the investment case. You know, there's a more short to medium term argument that says, is the base that's been set now sustainable? And then the longer term argument, which I think we have a bit more confidence on, is actually the fundamental drivers behind these businesses over the long term are very attractive.
Do you think that luxury brands will always be immune to a point to economic downturn? Because it's all about the psychology around consumer spending and the perception, I guess, of resilience.
That's right. I think immune is it's a relative term. You know, by and large, if globally we could look at the, you know, the global financial crisis of 2008, and no, luxury brands by and large were not immune. However, within that, there were some brands that did better than others. And, you know, as you would expect, the brands that tend to operate at the top end of the luxury market, and I know that that sounds strange because luxury by definition is, you know, the top end of the market, but if we think about the ultra premium brands, they tend to be a bit more resilient than those brands that are a bit more aspirational. And, you know, I guess what's got us interested about a company like Richemont, it's in a category that has structurally grown. They're benefiting from kind of a shift from unbranded jewelry to branded jewelry. And then they have probably the two most desirable brands in the luxury market at present, being Cartier and Van Cleef's. So, you know, you put that all together, certainly, you know, at an absolute level, brands are definitely not immune to tough economic scenarios. However, within that, there are certainly some brands that we think that can outperform others.
So there is a nice rebound at the moment. What's the house view then? Do you think that this trajectory is likely to continue presenting a good investment opportunity?
Yeah, so I think at present, you know, we did a bit more work on it late last year and we built a bit of conviction. Naturally, now valuations have run once again. So, you know, we're sharpening our pencils once again. I think, you know, for us, there're probably two important issues here. The, you know, the one is part of the reason for the sell-off last year was China. China is roughly 30% of global luxury spending, and as I know you and your listeners would be more than aware, you know, the Chinese economy hasn't been growing at the same rate as it has in previous periods, and consumers are certainly under pressure. So, you know, as consumption and excess consumption in China abated, you know, that was a drag to these luxury companies. I think people are a bit more hopeful now that maybe, you know, the Chinese consumer can once again grow off this base. I think it's something that is still uncertain and something that we're thinking about. The second part of this equation is the US. The US, you know, in the last 4 years has been the biggest contributor to growth in luxury. So, you know, as you would expect, you know, world-beating stock market, world-beating economy, you know, you put that all together and, you know, US consumers are in a much better place than they were, you know, 10 years ago, and as a result have disproportionately spent on luxury goods. Again, the key debate is US consumers still look strong and are still spending, but, you know, does that slow down and how much of that is priced into these shares?
Always enjoy our conversation. That is Jithin Pillay, Portfolio Manager at Allan Gray. I'm sure we'll talk again in the year. Really appreciate your time and thank you. And that is MoneyWeb at midday for today. The show is live weekdays at noon, then up as a podcast. Goodbye and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.